Now, in the middle of the fairway, could Brooke Henderson make birdie to win the second major title of her career, 6 years after her first at the Women's PGA Championship in 2016 when she was only 18? Henderson handled the pressure, hitting the third shot 6 feet and rolling in the putt for an even par round of 71. She was soaked in champagne by fellow players after clinching a one-stroke victory that certainly didn't come easy. Whether it's golf, football, track and field, or any other sport, the pressure of competing with other players, the pressure of competing against oneself, and the narrow margin between victory and defeat can put enormous physical and psychological stress on a player. What are the ongoing difficulties to men and women participating in sports, and what are the best ways of preventing or coping with those difficulties? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Dr. Claudia Reardon, professor in the Department of Psychiatry in the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's a very huge topic, the more I look at it, in terms of sports, the vast array of sports, and of course the vast array of how those sports are played, whether it's children in a field or high school or college competitors or professionals. So in a way, we could go with a lot of directions here. But in terms of just the psychology of a competitor, a sports competitor, what do you find in your experience?
It's a good question. You know, there is no one size fits all in terms of what is the psyche of a high level successful athlete looks like. But I think we can make generalizations, you know, what makes a person competitive in general, and that applies to sport, but also any area of life. And I think that's a combination of how people are born, probably their genetic predispositions, but also how life shapes them. And I think people who end up being highly competitive are motivated when they see others around them achieving success. They feel competitive. In the face of that, they want to achieve great success as well. They see many situations as competitive, even things that to you and me maybe don't appear to be competitive kinds of situations.
So there is a kind of a general psychology that gets somebody into sports. And what does the family environment or the peer environment play into at that point?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question too. And I have to admit that of great concern to me in recent years and even decades at this point is the increasing professionalization of youth sports, subspecialization where quite young children are doing a single sport year-round starting at a very young age. And I think a lot of kids and their families, understandably and with the best of intentions, assume that their children will become professional athletes if given the right opportunities to really excel and become specialists in a given sport. What I can say, what we do know, is that they're much more likely to get injured, much more likely to burn out, substantially less likely to have lifelong involvement in sport and physical activity and exercise. So probably that isn't the best way to become a high-level athlete. And I think it's really important for families to be active together and for families to encourage, as we call it, sport sampling, where their kids are allowed to try any number of different kinds of movement and physical activity, where kids are not made to feel that, oh my goodness, by the age of 10, my family has poured how many tens of thousands of dollars into my success in this single sport. And if I don't love this sport anymore, tough, there's no way for me to exit it because my family is so invested in my success in it.
With the possible exception of an injury, there are cases where you might have a very fine, say, high school basketball player, first day, first game of college basketball under scholarship, falls, fractures an elbow, that's it?
Yeah, I mean that, so that's a it's a big problem. Injury is a high risk time for mental health symptoms to emerge in athletes, and that's even more likely if their whole identity is wrapped up in sport and wrapped up in the role of athlete, because that's what their whole life has been, that single sport, and they haven't necessarily had the time or the opportunity to develop other interests. They don't necessarily have any friends outside of sport because they're only 24 hours in a day, and their teammates may be the only ones they're around. And so that really is a high-risk time for the development of things like depression and anxiety.
As far as this kind of implied need for versatility in a sport, what about the role of academics? Is that a plus or a minus? How does it all play into the life, the attitude of a person active in sports?
Academics, of course, are hugely important for many reasons. If an athlete is made to feel that sport is the only important thing in their life, or by far the most important thing, then that means there's a less well-rounded, holistic identity that young person has. And all the more reason why, then, if they need to exit from sport or want to exit from sport, they end up feeling depressed and anxious because they weren't encouraged to explore their interests or spend any time in academics or other extracurriculars or developing relationships outside of sport.
Do you have a sense that there are a lot of people going into sports as a way to rise economically?
That's the case for some, but not all. Really, there are different demographic groups and socioeconomic groups of athletes, and there are different motivating factors for the different groups.
Now, in some disciplines, we can say either at the grade school level or all the way up through professional levels, in some disciplines, the difference between failure and success is not always that clear. Or if you get, say, an 89 on your Spanish exam instead of a 90, there's not that big a difference. But if you miss that extra point by 1 yard, or you fail that race, come into second place by a tenth of a second, suddenly that small difference is huge, isn't it?
It is huge. That is such an interesting point. Thank you for making it. It reminds me of the interesting research lately that shows differences in mental health when it comes to individual sport athletes and team sport athletes. And compellingly, athletes in individual sports like track and field or cross country, for example, tend to have worse mental health, much higher likelihood of having depression or anxiety. And there are many hypotheses for why that might be, but some of them involve exactly what you're saying, and that is this very small margin of victory. You know, 1/100th of a second matters in the 100-meter dash, and there is no room for failure. You cannot let your guard down once, versus in a team sport, which, certainly isn't all roses either. There is enough pressure there to go around as well. But there is a sense a little bit more of, if we don't win, it didn't come down to 1/100th of a second. There's more of a dispersal of the blame over the entire team, if you will. And it's taken less personally in some cases.
Well, there's also this phenomenon earlier on in sports of just plain not making the cut, getting into the team. And do you see, for example, in any of your experience with working with young athletes, child athletes even, that this is an ongoing psychological problem for them?
It is. So, anytime you're talking about someone exiting out of sport, that is a higher risk time for development of things like depression and anxiety. And when it's an unwanted exit out of sport, such as you were cut for the from the team and you really did hope to make the team and ascend to that next level, that's an even greater risk mental health wise versus, you know, the athlete, the young person very intentionally and consciously choosing to leave sport because they want to pursue other interests. That's understandably a much lower risk kind of exit from sport.
Do you see a lot of individuals involved in sports who, if you ask them, so who are you? What is your identity? They would identify first as being a participant in sports as opposed to any number of other people who would maybe say their profession wasn't really their identity?
Yeah, there is quite a variety in that and how tightly someone holds the athlete role to their person and whether that's the first thing that they would identify as. There's certainly nothing wrong with taking pride in your role as an athlete and viewing that as an important part of your identity. But ideally, to optimize resilience, if you do get injured, if you do need to exit from sport, et cetera, there are other aspects to your identity. And I can just to share from my own practice, I see athletes in my psychiatry clinic all day, every day. And I can tell you the first thing I ask them about is not how is fill in the blank sport going? Because I know that's what everyone else asks them. So you will never, ever catch me being, you know, having that be the first thing I ask because, you know, if I'm the only one in their life emphasizing you are more than your sport, I'm going to be the person who takes the opportunity to do that. So I'm going to ask, how's school going? How's your family doing? And of course, how are you as a person doing? And then, you know, toward the end, you know, let's talk about your sport too.
What brings them in to see you?
As a sports psychiatrist, I treat athletes who have mental health symptoms and disorders. So people more commonly, I think of sports psychology, which really is about psychological performance enhancement, working on things like goal setting, imagery, modulation of emotional activation before a competition, like managing performance anxiety. But as a sports psychiatrist, I see the athletes when things are not going well, mental health wise, when they have significant concerns with anxiety, depression, eating disorders, substance use problems, et cetera.
And so what kind of cases have you seen in that regard? And just generally speaking, can mm-hmm. you give us some illustrations of that?
Yeah, well, so common things being common in athletes and non-athletes alike, anxiety disorders are the most common mental health disorders that we know of. And that bears true in the athletes that I see as well. They have a lot to be anxious about, unfortunately, ranging from sport-related factors, performance pressures, the need to make the team, the need to keep their scholarship in order to even be able to financially be able to stay in school. The fact that there are only 24 hours in a day and they have so much to balance between school and sport and family, et cetera. So anxiety is very, very common. Depression is also a common thing that I see. Depression, I think people think of high level athletes as glamorous and not possibly, you know, depressed and suffering in that way. And in fact, we know that high-level athletes are just as likely to suffer from depression as are non-athletes.
Even the very successful ones.
Absolutely. Yes. So a big, as we call it, meta-analysis study, that means looking at a whole lot of smaller studies and pooling the results together, looked at the rates of depression in elite athletes, I mean Olympic professional athletes, compared to the general population. And yes, elite athletes just as likely to suffer from depression.
Why would that be, do you think?
I think it comes down to all the different kinds of pressures that they're dealing with as athletes. superimposed on all the factors that cause depression in non-athletes, whether that's the genetic risk or the major life stressors, such as loss of loved ones or financial stress or whatever it is, plus all of the athlete-related stressors that I've already mentioned.
Are there sports that are particularly prone to that kind of depression?
Yeah, it again, getting back to that really interesting thread of research that shows that individual sport athletes suffer disproportionately compared to team sport athletes. So, for example, a big study by Andrew Wolinen looked at a whole lot of NCAA collegiate sports and found that women's track and field athletes were far and away the most likely to suffer from depression.
Is that because they're so much, what shall we say, exposed as an individual rather than in the context of a whole bunch of people on a team working in consort?
Yeah, I think there is that performance pressure. You're the one standing there on the line. Everyone's watching you. You're not out there with your entire team by your side. Other hypotheses include that in certain individual sports, there are much higher rates of injury. And as we've talked about, that is a higher risk time, mental health wise. that sense that I can't blame anyone but myself if I don't win. There is one winner and a lot more quote unquote losers in individual sports.
Oh,
only one person, one person on the line wins versus everyone else, if they think of themselves as a loser, versus in a team sport, 50% of the people win, in any competition.
Right. There has to be a lot of second guessing, I suppose, in an individual sport as to, only I had gone to bed 10 minutes earlier, or if I hadn't had that phone call that bothered me, I might have gotten that tenth of a second faster or higher or whatever it would be in an individual sport.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And related to that, some people hypothesize that the underlying pre-existing personality tendencies of people who are drawn to individual sports may just be more prone to anxiety and depression as well. So people who are more perfectionistic, for example, at baseline may be more drawn to individual sports. That's a gross oversimplification. But if you're perfectionistic, I mean, people think of that as, I have high standards. It's kind of like you say that with pride, if someone describes themselves as perfectionistic. But there are big problems that come with being perfectionistic. It's, I would argue it's not about having high standards. It's about having unrealistic standards. And then a lack of mental flexibility when it comes to what if you don't meet your unrealistically high expectations.
Offhand, I would say you would see much the same thing in professional musicians.
Yes. Oh, yes. Definitely we can extrapolate a lot of this to that population.
What part of the psychology of the people you see has to do with just not being able to overcome setbacks? I mean, we read in various other disciplines, business, for example, that the ones who really succeed are the ones who know how to turn failure into success, even if it's just because it's part of the learning experience.
Yes, absolutely. That is a common problem that we see. So that kind of perfectionistic approach to things is ultimately quite self-defeating. So it's built on really the irony that making and admitting mistakes is a necessary part of growing and learning and being human. But the perfectionist doesn't see it that way. It's very much a sort of all or nothing approach. I lost that race. I might as well quit. I might as well give in. What's the point anyways? I'm the worst athlete in the world kind of thing, versus viewing it as a learning experience, an opportunity to grow from.
We'll look further at the role of team pressure, team support, spectator support, and spectator pressure for that matter, and other aspects of sports psychology when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Dr. Claudia Reardon, professor in the Department of Psychiatry in the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking about sports psychology, a huge and varied topic. And now let's get into a little bit more about the role that the team plays, since we see, as you say, Claudia, that those in individual sports are more likely to have emotional or psychological issues than those in a team. What do you see as the pluses and minuses of being a member of a sports team?
Sure, and I definitely don't mean to make, you know, inappropriate sweeping generalizations, because there are pluses and minuses to being on a team, and certainly having the support of teammates can be a very helpful thing. I think there can also be pressures that come from participating in team sports, and, you know, you're living alongside, in some cases, and practicing alongside teammates who basically are competing with you for starting positions and scholarship dollars. And that it can be a difficult thing to be having to be competitive with your teammates and basically people who are your friends, because you don't necessarily have time to have friends outside of sport every single day. So it's a fine balance. How do you take the positives from the support that a teammate can offer while dealing with the competitive aspect that comes with that?
What kind of experience do you see regarding coaches' involvement in these problems, the creation of the problem or the amelioration of the problem?
I think coaches have the potential to be hugely influential in terms of helping to create an environment that promotes well-being for our athletes. And I think a lot of coaches do a very wonderful job with that. And at the same time, coaches don't often get a lot of training in how to do that. And I can tell you, you know, I certainly and others in my position hear about how that plays out when things don't go well with coaches. So if athletes perceive that they get differential attention, differing amounts of attention from coaches based on if they're performing well or not, well, that makes them feel like a commodity. That makes them feel like my worth is solely based on my sport performance and not on the fact that I'm human and deserve to be treated well and with positive regard.
We see, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, we see cases where maybe a really, really good quarterback, for example, has a couple of bad games and then somebody else is the quarterback. That kind of thing, that if you identify yourself as the quarterback of a team and then suddenly you're something else, that's where the real crisis begins. Again, that sense of identity that's eroded.
Right. Yes. And of course, coaches are in a difficult situation. I mean, talk about tremendous pressure to produce results. I mean, they're going to be out of a job if they don't produce results. Sure. And have winning teams. So there's the very distinct reality that, of course, they have to make tough decisions and play the athletes who are going to do the best for the team. But I think that's not incompatible with also treating all athletes as humans and making sure that you know, they perceive that, yes, they are worthy people, regardless of if they scored the game-winning goal or whatever it is. And I think it's also important for coaches to really role model and explicitly state that I care about you as a person and your well-being and your mental health. And it's not that I'm just going to try to chew you up and spit you out and get what I can get out of you sports performance wise, but actually care about your mind and I care about how you're doing as a person.
Well, when you have one of these patients, a sports person that has these issues, as a psychiatrist, are you in a position to then talk to the other people involved, I mean, the coaches, for example, or family members?
All day, every day, I'm talking with other members of, as we call it, the athlete entourage, people who are involved in the athlete's life on a daily basis. So I am in regular communication with the team physician. So that's a primary care sports medicine team physician who is in charge of all of the athlete's health, every body system. I'm involved in their mental health specifically, but the team doctor is involved in all aspects of their care. A lot of times there are dietitians with whom I'm working. There may be psychologists or other counseling staff, the athletic trainers. I'm talking to them every day, and also frequently talking with the coaches, sometimes the parents as well, if the athletes are willing to have me do that. Because it's very, very important that we are all on the same page in terms of treatment recommendations. And also everyone has such a distinct vantage point. And if we bring all of our information and expertise together, we can really do best in terms of a comprehensive treatment approach.
If we talk about the UW, and you probably could address it on a broader scale too, but if we talk about the University of Wisconsin, for example, and a student coming into a team, whether it's a team sport or let's say, you know, individual sports that involve a group of people as a team, are you aware if there's any actual indoctrination in terms of the psychology of sports as part of their curriculum?
They do get basic information on the mental health aspects of treatments and help that are available to them. And that can range from there's no diagnosable mental health condition, but you want to work on optimizing your performance, what can be done mentally, all the way to, you know, if you have concerns about suicidality or eating disorder, bad depression or anxiety, here's what that looks like, and here are the treatment options available to you.
Some of those students fall between the cracks?
I'm sure they do. There's no way they don't, because people with mental health symptoms or disorders fall through the cracks in every sphere of the world. And I will admit that when it comes to mental health problems, stigma in sport is almost certainly higher than it is in a lot of other spheres. And part of that, you know, is related to the culture of toughness in sport. And it's hard for athletes to turn off that game face when they step off the field or the court and say, you know, yes, I'm suffering. You know I was a tough competitor out there, but I really do need help. And athletes understandably worry about loss of playing time or loss of potential scholarships or drafting to professional sports if it's known that they're suffering from mental health symptoms. Now, of course, there's a high regard for confidentiality when it comes to mental health, and certainly I can't go telling anyone about my athlete patients' concerns or anything they tell me unless they give me explicit permission to do that. But nonetheless, athletes understandably have the concern that, you know, how confidential is this really?
Reminds me a little bit, or it seems analogous to what we hear about the military also. I mean, because again, the emphasis is on toughness and on success and capability. And we hear more and more about people in the military in these analogous to sports situations where they don't want to seek help because they think it's some kind of a stigma.
People do commonly and appropriately draw parallels between sport and military, definitely.
Well, in terms of the high profile of sports, in other words, well, we started out with a reading from the morning newspaper describing what a woman, a PGA competitor, had done to overcome, perhaps with some luck, you know, a challenge of hers. Do we see the media affecting the psychology of sports figures?
I sure think it does. And, you know, our athletes are subjected to a lot of negative media attention. I think there's a sense that our athletes won't be affected by commentary that people make in the media, whether that's social media and some random person criticizing our, you know, a high-level athlete versus a major news network offering critical commentary on an athlete. And I tell you, nothing breaks my heart more than to read those things because I know the athletes are going to read it themselves or they're going to be told about it. And yes, they're human, surprise, they're affected by it. And I hear about it in my office, and it does affect their mental health. And so, you know, my answer is often just don't look at it. There's nothing good that's going to come from looking at that. But my plea to everyone is to just remember that our athletes are human, and they are vulnerable to those harsh words.
Does remind me again of other disciplines, whether it's music or literature, where you ask an author or a musician about reviews and they said, I don't read them. It's perhaps a good way
Exactly.
to maintain your game.
For sure. Definitely.
And what do you see in terms of the role between or the connection between injury and psychology? If it's, let's not say that it's a a major injury, but any kind of injury, physical, how does it play into the mental health of an athlete?
Yeah, good point. Good question. It again, oftentimes comes down to how much of athlete identity is part of the person's life. So, is their whole entire identity wrapped up in that of an athlete? Because if it is, then what happens if you're injured and can no longer participate in sport, either for the short term or the long term? That means who am I then? If I'm not athlete, you know, I haven't been encouraged to dive into academics, other activities. All my friends are through sport, and now I'm not at practice or competition, so I don't have any social network at all because I didn't have time to develop those other social relationships. So it's a very high risk time from that standpoint. Again, depression, anxiety, it's a very high risk time for development of eating disorders in a lot of athletes because there's great fear about bodily changes when they're suddenly not able to work out to the same very high level that they were before. And so there's inappropriate compensation in terms of how they change their dietary practices. So it is a high risk time.
Do you see a gender difference in those eating disorders?
Yes. So, first of all, let me just say that all genders can be and are affected by disordered eating and eating disorders. But at the risk of making, you know, sweeping generalizations, certainly athletes who identify as female are at much greater risk for eating disorders. There's certainly a lot of social pressures and media pressures that come into that. But eating disorders are something that I treat all the time, many, many times every single day in athlete patients. And whether that's at the time of injury or any time over the sport, over the time of an athlete's sporting career, they are really painfully common.
And eating disorders take what form? What do you see?
Yeah, good question. So there are several different forms of eating disorders. I think people think eating disorder and they think of someone who's unnaturally and inappropriately thin.
Yes.
And that's one small aspect of it. That's classically what is called anorexia nervosa, which is significant underweight, fear of gaining weight. But there are many other forms. So, for example, bulimia nervosa is an eating disorder where people alternately have times of binging, which means eating very large amounts of food in a way that feels really out of control, beyond comfortably full. It's painful. And then inappropriate compensatory behaviors to make up for that. Things
Purging.
like yeah, purging, and that includes exercising way more than they are told to, other forms of purging as well. There's binge eating disorder as well, which is just the binging side of things. So it comes in many different flavors and many different body habituses.
I would just guess that with male athletes, or at least again in the more physically aggressive sports, that the eating might take the form of eating a lot, as opposed to in some of the other sports, as you say, thinning down. But that's probably, again, a really big overgeneralization.
It is a generalization, but it's also accurate. Certainly that plays out. So the so-called leanness sports are where we do disproportionately see eating disorders. So sports where a lean body habitus is perceived to be beneficial, or sports where there are weight classes, or you need to meet a certain weight cutoff.
Like wrestling, for example.
Exactly. Wrestling and lightweight rowing, judo, and sports, if the athletes are judged and they perceive that their appearance influences judging, and gravitational sports where there's a sense of gravity mattering, and the more I weigh, that's going to slow me down, kind of thing. So those sports are on average more likely to suffer from eating disorders, but again, all athletes in all sports can suffer.
Do you ever see a case where an athlete blames his or her problem on one other individual, whether it's a competitor off the on another team or on their own team, or somebody who failed them in terms of just their development?
Yeah, that can certainly be the way a person would come in and talk about what factors they believe to be contributing to their mental health concerns. And that may be entirely valid. I mean, there are, you know, for the number of athlete patients I have, that's how many different stories and, you know, sets of contributing factors I have. So for most mental health disorders, that they are multifactorial in origin, meaning there are multiple factors that contributed to them. It's rare, really, very, very rare that I see someone and they come to me and they have major depressive disorder. And I say, your depression is because of this one factor. You know, it's because of genetic risk that your parents, you know, gave you that you inherited. It's really not that simple in psychiatry. It's usually a whole host of biological and psychological and social factors.
We're going to look further at the phenomenon of sports psychology and how it applies both to people in sports and people who have, at least to some extent, put sports behind them professionally or personally, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Dr. Claudia Reardon. She's a professor in the Department of Psychiatry in the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. We're talking about the phenomenon of sports psychiatry. Psychiatry, inevitably, is linked to not just mind, but the physical nature of an individual. And there is such a thing as being addicted to that level of activity, isn't there?
Ooh, good question. Yeah, so exercise addiction per se is not an official psychiatric diagnosis, but there's a lot about it that's been researched, and we know that it probably does exist. And in many ways, it does appear to be similar to other addictive disorders, substance use disorders, such as alcohol use problems, cannabis use problems, et cetera. And this can be really hard to tease out in a high-level athlete. You know, what is normal, helpful, adaptive levels of exercise in a high-level athlete who does the sport for a living versus where does it cross that line? The abnormal, unhealthy territory. And so the things that we think about are, is the athlete doing exercise even in inappropriate times, such as when they're injured, and continuing to exercise actually aggravates the injury. And they know that, but they're still exercising to that, you know, harmful degree. Does the athlete say, you know, I'm trying to cut down, I realize that I can't keep doing more and more and it's making injuries or whatever worse, but I can't, I really can't do it. So they're aware that that degree of exercise is causing problems, but they continue to do it because they really can't. And any regular exerciser may describe and probably does describe feeling better with sport and physical movement. It feels good. It helps you feel relaxed and more calm and more energetic ultimately. And on days when maybe you can't exercise for whatever reason, you know, you maybe feel slightly off, but the athlete or the person who is quote unquote exercise addicted will feel very bad. Very, very bad. I mean, quite depressed and or anxious if they are not able to or allowed to exercise on a given day. And it really, as you can imagine, starts to affect their life. It affects their relationships, their jobs, if they have one outside of sports, school, whatever it is, because it's just like any other addiction. It just takes over their life.
Now, let's say somebody who is a runner, whether it's on a team or just for their own benefit, a long distance runner, and we see them all the time, all throughout the year, of course. What is the physiology of something like that? And also, what are the rewards that any athlete needs? What, I mean, are there substitutes for winning the big game or, you know, having lots of public acclaim that a person deep into sports can use to find it rewarding?
Yeah, good question. Well, to that first part, I think, you know, running is the sport we think of most often when we think of exercise addiction. There's even a phrase coined for it, obligatory running, which is probably, you know, exercise addiction in running form. And, you know, there is something to the runner's high, which is probably endorphins and other feel-good hormones in the brain that runners and other athletes experience when exercising to high intensity or prolonged periods of time. And, you know, it's not an inherently bad thing. I'm glad that exercise makes people feel good if and when it does. And again, you ask the question, when is it starting to cause problems? If it's causing problems, then maybe we need to think about incorporating other things into one's life that can be rewarding as well.
What kind of thing would that be?
It's different for every person. I mean, that could be other sorts of extracurricular activities. Maybe it's a musical pursuit, maybe it's prioritizing relationships, interpersonal relationships, but it's really an individual kind of thing.
Do people in sports majors, again, talking college here, people in sports majors tend to identify more closely with that as their identity as opposed to people in other majors? And if that's the case, would they have more trouble adjusting after college?
Well, that's a good question. So, for example, if their major is kinesiology, a sport-related field, does that then necessarily mean that their identity is more tied up in sport and athletics? And so that's a marker for, if they're an athlete, a harder time exiting out of sport. Well, that is a good question, and there's not a straightforward answer, because one of the things that we know that helps people transition out of the role of high-level athlete is if they feel like there's a role for them to continue to use the knowledge and experiences that they've gained from sport.
Right.
And so if they, you know, if their major's kinesiology and they're going to have continue to have some involvement in sport, you know, through their academic field of study, that's a way for them to continue to use that role and that identity for good and, you know, for their career. So that's not necessarily a bad thing.
We've seen it in professional players every year, the difficulty of retiring, just letting go of it.
Yeah.
How do people, after they retire, whether it's from college sports or professional sports, how do they cope? And is there any kind of training or information for collegiate players in particular as to what they do at the end of the 4 years? What do they do after that to adjust?
That's something that I do think practitioners in the field do need to move toward giving more time and attention to. I continue to see a number of athletes after they've retired from sport, but say they may still be college students here. So I'm still seeing them. And that is a tough transition. They go from being so busy and heavily involved in their sport and they never. Yes. And recognized, so heavily scheduled that they've never had to figure out how to structure free time in their life, because they've never had free time in their life. They've never had to come up with their own exercise regimen to stay healthy and physically active, because it's always imposed on them. I mean, they definitely don't need to do any more than what is being asked by their coaches, to suddenly, oh my goodness, I have some free time. What in the world do I do with that? That can feel bad. It can feel unproductive. They feel lazy. You know, what am I doing with my day? You know, understandably, they take some time off from exercise for the first time in their life, but that doesn't necessarily feel good either. And they're not sure, you know, what do I want to do for sport and exercise? Do I want to keep doing what I did as a collegiate athlete, the same sport? Well, not necessarily, because I only know how to do that at a very high competitive level. And if I'm not sort of, you know, accomplishing at the same level I was before, that's not going to feel good. So then what other activity do I want to do? So those are all things that I hope that athletes have a chance to talk about and strategize before they get to the point of retirement.
Because you have this impulse, I would think, as a competitor, to want to get better and better and better, with the realization that ultimately, physically, you'll reach your limit and you won't get better. You won't be as good as you were last year, 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
Right. And that's a really hard pill to swallow for people. So if they were a high-level runner, how feasible does it feel for them to just now be a recreational runner? Or do they want to, you know, switch to playing pickup basketball for exercise?
Sure. What kind of advice can you give a person like that? Because it will certainly apply to a lot of college athletes.
It does. So I just talk to them about what are their general perceptions, because some know right off the bat, there is no way I am ever swimming again. Either I totally fell out of love with that sport, or I just know myself and there's no way I would be okay with just recreational level swimming or whatever the sport is. And if they know that right off the bat, then we can talk about, okay, well, then what are the other options? And really coming up with some details to their plan for how they're going to put that into place.
Do you ever see in your dealings with athletes at any role or any part of their life, do you see, let's say, a parent figure who is trying to compete vicariously through this person and therefore putting undue pressure on them?
Sure, absolutely. And of course, that's not unique to sport. I mean, that's, sure, you know, achievement by proxy academically and musically, certainly athletically. And I mean, 99% of the time, it's not because the parent has bad intentions and, you know, their perspective is not, I'm going to push my kid, you know, to the breaking point of anxiety and panic and depression, you know, no way. That's not part of it, but they, you know, take on and experience and perceive the excitement of their kid's success in sport, and truly from the standpoint of wanting to support their kid and share in that enthusiasm and excitement. It does and can take up that element of achievement by proxy, as you might call it. And, you know, that obviously can tip over into the young person feeling a lot of pressure to succeed, because that's what, you know, what my parent wants me to do.
In your experience, the role of prescription drugs and college sports?
Yeah, and so prescription psychiatric medications, I imagine you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure. So as a psychiatrist, that is one tool in our armamentarium, one of many. So certainly psychotherapy, which is talk therapy, is a helpful tool for all sorts of mental health symptoms and disorders. And at a certain point, when you're talking typically about moderate to severe symptoms, medications are quite helpful and can be life-saving.
But they can also be abused one way or the other, even if they're prescription drugs?
Some medications can be abused. Certainly there are medications that may be performance enhancing. Those kinds of medications are quite tightly regulated in higher levels of sports, starting at the collegiate level, typically, or anytime you're talking about national or international competition. So there's a pretty tight lid on that. It's a real issue in sport for sure, but not something that I see a common problem with, at least at the collegiate level where I spend most of my time.
Well, as I said, it's certainly a broad and diverse topic, but one that we don't really hear much about from the outside, and that is the whole role of psychiatry in sports, particularly college sports. But you've given us some idea of what goes on behind the scenes there, and behind the thrill of victory, which can also have a downside, and certainly the agony of defeat. My guest has been Dr. Claudia Reardon. She's a professor in the Department of Psychiatry in the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, and thanks for enlightening us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Air. Thank you.